Today's WBFO brief was recorded at around 8:30 in the morning. This is WBFO News.
Some Buffalo Bills fans are putting their money behind the construction of the team's new stadium. Erie County Comptroller Kevin Hardwick said his office sold $2.71 million worth of so-called Bills bonds, the tax-exempt bonds that will help finance the county's $250 million obligation to the stadium project. The Buffalo News reports just over 100 people purchased the bonds during the retail sale on Monday. The county is issuing a total of $125 million for the bonds worth for the stadium project and had received more than $200 million in orders from small retail investors and financial institutions. Gun arrests continue to pile up in the city of Buffalo. Police report 14 gun-related arrests were made and 16 guns recovered during the week of September 16th through the 22nd. Among the cases was the September 20th arrest of 38-year-old Buffalo man on Jefferson Avenue. Police say a loaded Charter Arms Corps Bulldog revolver was recovered during the arrest of Frank Claro Toledo. Due to two prior felony convictions, Claro Toledo was remanded following his arrest. And organizers of the New York State Fair are declaring success after drawing over 868,000 visitors to the 13-day event in Syracuse. The State Department of Agriculture reports increased activity at many of the fair's initiatives, including the Taste NY pop-up market, which enjoyed an 18% rise in transactions for the 332 products offered by 87 vendors. Federal emergency assistance will be flowing to Allegheny County and other parts of the Southern Tier impacted by flooding caused by Hurricane Debby in August. Congressman Nick Langworthy and Governor Kathy Hochul jointly made the announcement yesterday that the designation from the federal government would allow impacted homeowners in Allegheny County eligible up to $50,000 in grants. With nearly 6 inches of rain falling in some locales within a matter of hours, flooding wiped out farm crops, damaged roads, and left workers with a massive cleanup effort. The NFTA is looking to invest in and expand existing paratransit access lines in their monthly public meeting. Project manager Bill Schwartz is leading the study. He said that because of funding costs, staffing, and bus fleet, it would take about 5 years for the potential project to be completed. In the meantime, alternate service options, including supplemental ride-sharing trips, are being considered. And a programming note that Skin in the Game comes your way again this coming Friday on WBFO, featuring sports marketing guru John Simperman and sports business journalist Tim O'Shai. They'll be welcoming this week Andrew Zimblist, economist, professor at Smith College, and the author of more than two dozen books on the economics of sports. They'll be on for Skin in the Game this Friday at 6 p.m. on WBFO.
This WBFO Brief podcast is made possible by Canisius University, where high-flying grifts find a top-flight education. For the last 8 years, Canisius has been recognized on U.S. News' list of best colleges and universities. Learn more at canisius.edu.
Hi, I'm Emily Watkins, and this is the WBFO Disabilities Beat. We're taking a break this week, but we will be back with new content soon. In the meantime, here's an episode you may have missed.
In April, the University of Buffalo hosted adaptive yoga teacher Matthew Sanford to not only train yoga teachers and medical professionals, but to educate the community on how to develop body-to-mind resilience. Sanford, who's also an author and founded the nonprofit Mind Body Solutions, sat down with me for an interview before one of his classes at UB. Here's part of our conversation, edited for length and clarity.
So I am 58 now, so I've been doing this a long time. I feel like a grizzled veteran at this point, practicing for 33 years. But I was injured in a car accident when I was 13. My father and sister were killed. My mother and brother weren't physically hurt. And I went through a shredder. I broke my neck and my back, both my wrists, filled the lung with fluid, and had an injury to my pancreas that left me unable to eat for 60 days. I was in a coma. So I woke out of, we were just traveling on an, we hit an icy patch on a day that was misting. So the unthinkable happened in my family, right? I woke up from that. And the medical model, they saved my life. I mean, I was so injured, right? I was in the hospital for 6 months. Can you imagine what that would be now? Can't even imagine. No one would pay for that, right? But basically, the rehabilitation vision that I encountered was to basically, I'm paralyzed from the injury that sustained and hurt my spinal cord was a T4, so about my chest. And basically, I was guided to make my upper body really strong and learn to drag my paralyzed body through life, which is kind of a cultural meme of disability. You're supposed to overcome it like it's an obstacle. But the truth is, it's the only body you're ever going to have. Right. So, and I was a very athletic young boy, and I missed my body. And I did what I was supposed to do. I stopped listening to my lower body, learned to manage my life. But I missed my body, and I was in graduate school at the time and studying philosophy and the mind-body problem. Duh. Yeah. I didn't even know I was thinking about myself. And I just decided it was time for me to try to re-inhabit my body. And I thought, what better way to do that than a time-tested practice that's about integrating mind and body and whatever people want to call spirit.
If it's okay, I want to ask you about that experience of grief. I mean, you woke up and your whole life had changed. How do you come to terms with that? And what was that experience of grief like?
Well, the one thing about the experience of disability is that it's ongoing. I sometimes joke and say it takes 10 years to realize you're disabled. Mm-hmm. And so it's a slower process. You wake up, and I'm also focused on losing my father and sister because they were also killed in the accident. Yeah. So I've got a whole bunch of grief. And yet I'm a young kid, and I've got my whole life in front of me. And it takes wisdom to know how to process grief. So I was more in the early days thinking about trying to get back to my life, trying to prove to everybody I could do my life despite being disabled, right? And be involved in school and be involved in other things, right? So early on, I would say I tried to plug back in, kind of like what you do. The thing about grief is that it's an ongoing process, and even now I'm going through new levels of grief at 58. I'm aging with a spinal cord injury, and now I'm realizing some of the full implications and how hard it is now as my body also ages. So in terms of jumping back into my life, at first I wanted to prove that I was okay. And then part of coming to yoga was I started to really grieve at 25. I missed my body. Coming back alive after you've abandoned your body is full of grief because there's nothing more painful. It's a great line from Toni Morrison's Beloved, right? There's nothing more painful than coming alive from the dead. And in some ways, I left my body behind like I could never be on the inside of my paralyzed body. And that's just not true. But coming back to life, a process that's beautiful and whatever, it has to have grief. One of the things that I think about grief is that it's a precondition of realization. It's a stunning human innovation, right? It's like the watering of dry soil. And I love that it actually, you drop tears from your eyes, right? Like you're watering again to land in what's true and what's been lost, and figuring out how to come back and move forward. So grieving, the one thing I would say from how much I've been through, and I've been through a lot, right? It's not just that injury, is that I'm not afraid of grieving. I now recognize that it's part of the process of becoming, and that doesn't mean I like it. But I'm not afraid of tears. I'm not afraid that I'm weepy. I'm really sensitive. It's okay, right? And I want the world to be a better place. All of those things, but I want to come at it from a sense of my own vulnerability, and grieving is vulnerable. We try to avoid grief, and we shouldn't. It's how we become. So yes, it was hard to plug back into my life, right? And I still, like right now, you know, as you come towards retirement, like I'd love to travel all the time, but my body's worn out, you know, and I'd like to see more of the world, and there's a whole bunch of experiences I'm not going to get. And that's always been true when you live with a disability, right? You're always, you know, I'm not going to go to the upstairs of your house, even if you invited me, if you have a really cool deck. I'm not going there. I accept certain things. They're still losses. I can't pretend they're not losses. This is not the body I wanted, right? But boy, I wouldn't trade it. I've had quite a life.
Talk to me about that. You wouldn't trade it. I mean, I can understand, but I think a lot of people, when you talk to them and say, like, I wouldn't trade my life as a disabled person, it kind of shocks them because they think disability is, like, the worst thing that can happen.
Right, and that's from their perspective. I would, I mean, obviously I'd trade if my father and sister could be alive and have a full life, so there's clearly, you know, I'd go back and trade
Absolutely.
It. I remember the moment when I realized this, it was when, really deeply, there was a moment where I've always helped, you know, talked about what it is to be disabled. And I was just first practicing yoga. And I was a couple years into it, and I was teaching to a bunch of first graders, seven-year-olds. There's nothing more beautifully innocent than young kids, because they just ask the most beautiful questions, and they're very direct, right? And I'm saying all these things about yoga and all I can still do, and then this little kid comes up to me and says, but don't you miss walking? And it was beautiful, and the answer is yeah. Yeah, I'd like to go on a hike. I'd like to do all that. And I said to him, and I could say it, and that only came after yoga, I wouldn't trade what I'm becoming. This is the only life I get to have, right? I can't imagine. I never would have been a yoga teacher. I can tell you that for sure. Yeah. I wouldn't become a philosopher of consciousness and writing a book on the limits of minds and the importance of body, right? I wouldn't do any of that, right, if I hadn't had the one life I get. Right, so I don't want to try to overcome my life and prove anything to anybody. But that means I have to be okay with the losses, too. And that's a process, and it's a change.
You can listen to the Disabilities Beat on demand, view a transcript and plain language description for every episode on our website at wbfo.org.
One Buffalo rang true on Monday with both the Sabres and Bills coming out victorious. And WNBA playoffs are underway. I'm Jack Cruiser. This is The Scoreboard for Wednesday, September 25th. Despite being 2-0, there were a lot of questions entering the Bills' Monday night game versus Jacksonville, but it's safe to say that most of them were answered as Highmark Stadium was in party mode all night, with Buffalo winning 47-10. The first question I had entering this game was whether or not that dominant win in Week 2 over Miami was a one-off performance. The answer, no, that was not a fluke. Buffalo looked just as sound, if not more so, from the opening kickoff on Monday night as the offense scored touchdowns on all five of their first half drives, and the defense made Trevor Lawrence look like a JV quarterback from the get-go, taking a 34-3 lead into the locker room. Offensive coordinator Joe Brady answered question number two: can the Bills be equally as effective in the passing game as they were on the ground in Week 2? Last season in London, the Jaguars took away the Bills' run game and forced Josh Allen to create through the air. On Monday, Joe Brady and Allen teamed up to prove yes, they may very well have the MVP of the league at quarterback and have an abundance of talent surrounding him as pass catchers, with 10 players recording a reception for over 260 yards through the air Monday night. Similar to the first question, the defense needed to prove that Week 2's shutdown of Miami's offense wasn't a rarity either. Recording 5 sacks from 5 different players, 6 tackles for losses, and an emotional first career interception for DeMar Hamlin, the Bills' defense proved that they're legit once again. With the 47-10 win, the Bills move to 3-0 and face a challenging schedule ahead, playing on primetime again next week. The Bills are heading to Baltimore for a Sunday night meeting with the Ravens before games at Houston, then in New Jersey against the Jets in the coming 3 weeks. It was the first instance of one Buffalo with both the Bills and the Sabres winning on the same day this fall, as the Buffalo Sabres defeated Columbus 6-1 in a preseason game Monday evening. Once again, the blue and gold went up against a lineup of mostly AHL players. The Sabres' power play certainly looks improved from last season and its 16% success rate, which ranked 29th in the NHL. The Sabres opened the scoring on a 2-man advantage tally from Owen Power, but after that goal, just over 5 minutes in, the Sabres sat back and didn't record another shot for the rest of the first period, something that coach Lindy Ruff made sure to mention his displeasure with postgame. Buffalo went on to dominate the second and third periods, and overall, the offense was proficient again, with 6 different Sabres scoring in the 6-1 win, and 13 players recording a point. The only real negative was the lack of production from the Greenway-McLeod-Zucker line, which was the only combination not to appear on the score sheet. The Sabres will roll out a fully prospect and minor league lineup for the remainder of the preseason in North America, as 27 players are in Europe as part of the NHL's Global Series. The Sabres will play an exhibition in Germany against Red Bull Munich on Friday afternoon before opening the regular season next week versus New Jersey in Czechia. Playoffs are underway in the WNBA. To dive into it all, I sat down with WBFO's Thomas O'Neill White for our WNBA wrap-up.
Coming into this game, too, Caitlin Clark has to be at her best. If she's not at her best, they really don't have a chance. I do like how Aaliyah Boston played last game, but, you know, it starts and ends with Caitlin Clark. She is the engine that keeps this team going. If she's not shooting well, she's still out assists, getting that ball up the court quickly. That's how they want to play. And if they're not playing like that, they're going to struggle.
The full conversation is available on the web at WBFO.org. Former Canisius High School football star and current UB Bull Nick McMillan has officially been ruled out for the rest of the 2024 season after suffering a knee injury in Week 2. The redshirt sophomore was listed as the Bulls' top wide receiver to open the season. Week 3 of the high school football season was filled with star-studded performances. The full list of Connolly Cup nominees is at WBFO.org. This has been The Scoreboard for Wednesday, September 25th. I'm Jack Cruiser for WBFO Sports.
Don't forget to like or subscribe so you can help others find this podcast. And if you love it, leave a review too. The WBFO Brief Podcast and the award-winning journalism of WBFO's news team are made possible by our members. Thank you for listening.